Hi, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is New Books in East Asian Studies. Welcome, and thank you for joining us. I just spoke with Tamara Chin about her new book, which I'm really excited about, Savage Exchange, Han Imperialism, Chinese Literary Style, and the Economic Imagination. This came out in 2014 with the Harvard University Asia Center. Now, this is the fourth time that I'm recording this intro because I'm so excited about this book that each time I've tried to do this, I have gone on and on and on about all the wonderful things about it. So I'm going to keep it really short this time and just say, I love this book. It's an important book. It's a path-breaking, really brilliant and thoughtful book, and you should go out and get a copy and read it. Why? So it looks at early China in a particular period. This is largely focused on the reign of Han Emperor Wu, who reigned from 141 to 87 BCE. And what it does is it looks at documents from this period, and documents include not just excavated and received texts, but mittens and coins and other kinds of material artifacts. And it looks at these documents from a perspective that brings together, puts into dialogue, and mutually informs both literary studies and a sort of comparative literature approach that looks at the aesthetics and literary qualities of text in a really fine-grained way, and a political and economic historical approach that's concerned with markets and economy and global trade and frontier histories. And it makes these two modes of reading speak to each other in a way that really opens up and troubles in all the best possible ways how we understand early China, how we understand how to read texts and which texts to read together in early China, and how we understand what can be considered under the rubric of kind of economic history and economic studies. It's a beautifully written book. I can't recommend it highly enough. So I hope you enjoy. It was really a pleasure to talk with Tamara, and I'm both grateful for her time, and I'm also grateful for your time. So thank you for listening. I hope you enjoy, and see you soon. I'm here today to talk with Tamara Chin about her really, really, really fantastic new book, Savage Exchange. Welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies, Tamara. Thanks for making time. Thanks for writing an awesome book. And thank you for being here. I'm really looking forward to it.
Thanks, Carla.
So could you start us off, Tamara, by saying a little bit about your background and specifically, how did you come to work on early China?
Well, I came to early China by a slightly circuitous route. I've always been interested in antiquity and the politics of antiquity. And I originally started in classics. And then I went to graduate school in comparative literature because I wanted to actually work on comparative Greek and Chinese geography, ethnography, and those sorts of topics. And while I was beginning work on early Chinese texts, I realized I really needed to work on early Chinese texts, and I basically ended up having to really retool and go through the text properly. And so the dissertation ended up being a dissertation entirely on Chinese texts. And ever since, more or less since graduate school, I've just had to work on Chinese texts, but I'm, you know, looking forward in the future to coming back again to more comparative themes. But that's how I got to the field originally.
Great. Well, thank you. So the book that we're talking about today is both at the same time a contribution to several genres and also a work that in many ways transcends genre in all the best possible senses of that description. So it's a kind of literary political economy of early China. It's a book that focuses on the reign of Han Emperor Wu. And this is a period that, as you tell us in the book, is significant, and it's significant for the focus of the book in part in that it marks, in your words, China's earliest expansion of monetized markets and the largest scale its extension of frontiers in Chinese imperial history. So in this period, what's happening with this expansion is that officials and scholars are taking the figure of the market as an inspiration for reform, and kind of discussions of relationships between the frontier and the market are taking place at the same time and are really embedded within discussions about the relationship between the word and the written text. Okay, so I'll pause there because there's a lot more to say. It's a fascinating, fascinating study. So Tamara, what brought you to this particular kind of focus, and perhaps a focus on economy specifically as the central motivating force of this work?
Well, I started out mainly thinking about political expansion. As I mentioned before, I'd originally thought of, I'd been interested in the Silk Road actually since childhood. I had the opportunity to travel a fair amount in China, and there was always this idea that I could somehow connect, you know, China and Greece in some way. And I was interested in histories of contact, and I thought for my dissertation I would look at representations of the foreigner, and that's what the dissertation was really about. And there's a significant change during the Han Dynasty because of imperial expansion when you start getting, you know, the earliest extended forms of representations of foreigners. So it's a distinct change in the tone and in the format, in the genre. But what I found was, unlike in the kind of paradigmatic cases of ways in which ethnography is studied in literary departments, in, especially as modeled by, say, Said's Orientalism or Mary Louise Pratt's work, it wasn't so clear cut in some of the texts that I was reading, or at least in the Shiji text, that this kind of ethnography was preparing the way for expansion in exactly the same way. And so what troubled me was the ways in which the texts I was looking at precisely to look for ethnography weren't troubled by this sort of alien, inferior foreigner at the moment of expansion, so much as they were troubled and anxious about issues around exchange and things and the traffic in objects that was accompanying expansion, and that was a product of the need to massively expand state-regulated markets and to expand local and long-distance markets in order to finance expansion into Central Asia. So post-dissertation, basically, I began to pursue what was there in the texts themselves, as opposed to what I sort of went in there, you know, looking to find, in the way that I sort of looked at Herodotus or, you know, looked at, you know, 19th century texts or what have you. So it was really something I wasn't expecting to have to look at. And sort of since then, it's I've been very much drawn into thinking about literary approaches to the economy, cultural approaches to the economy. So I've had to do a lot more reading around anthropological work around the histories of ways of thinking about economic thought. So there was a reorientation of the work that meant a rewriting, actually, of the entire dissertation. So that's what happened, actually, which is why it took so long to write. I mean, unfortunately, it's one of those books that, that took longer than it should have.
Oh, no. I mean, I think, you know, there are, so as somebody, just speaking as somebody who reads a lot of academic books, right, you can tell when, or it's very clear when there's a book that should have taken a long time to write and was absolutely worth taking whatever time it needed. And this is that book. I mean, this is a book that, just for listeners who haven't yet had a chance to read it, this is going to be a classic book. You know, this is not just a first book. This is potentially a field-changing book. And I think it sounds like whatever transformations needed to happen from the dissertation to this, and whatever time that needed to take, I for one, am really glad you took the time, because it's an amazing process.
Thank you, Carla.
So you've already really talked a little bit about the transition from dissertation to book, and it sounds more like a transformation, really, from kind of the ground up than a transition. Yeah,
absolutely. And I think, you know, I was fortunate along the way after completing the dissertation to spend a year, or I spent, actually it was a semester at the Institute for the Study of the Ancient World at NYU with a bunch of mainly archaeologists. I think they were all archaeologists except for me, and they all worked on frontiers and all bits of sort of Eurasia. And they were looking at issues around exchange in different ways and thinking about the material world in ways that really helped me to make this transition in another way. So that was part of what also both slowed down but helped the process along the way in thinking about material history, which is why it became less literary as well along the way.
Great. So the book itself is very transdisciplinary, and it's also based on an archive that's extraordinarily plural. So what it does, among other things, we'll just kind of start to get into it, it brings kind of literary scholarship and scholarship on kinds of representation, including visual representation, into a conversation with more kind of political, historical, economic studies of China. And in doing so, it bases the research on an archive that includes received texts, excavated texts, and kinds of documents that are made of, you know, fabric, mittens, coins, other kinds of material objects. So it's a really diverse, really, I think, wonderfully diverse archive that it's based on. You mentioned in the very introduction to the book that, among other things, one of the kinds of work that the book does is to take two fields that don't often speak to each other and not just make them speak to each other, but make them learn from each other in terms of the process and methodology of the field. So it both, in your words, challenges linear narratives of Chinese empire that are derived from traditional interpretations of Han literary texts, right? So some Han, early Chinese literary studies, but also showcases the benefits of a more, as you put it, literary and cultural approach to economic history. So what happens really if we make these two fields speak to each other? And I think that's one of the really beautiful things about the book, and it's one of the things I think we'll talk about much more. Okay, so so let's get right into it, because there are a lot of amazing chapters and I want to make sure we have time to get to them. So the chapters of the book are kind of broken up into two parts. The first three chapters of the book each look at discursive genres. So philosophical kind of master's dialogue, epideictic fu. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly, but we're just going to go with it. And you can
absolutely.
And historiography. And the final two chapters rather before the coda look at social practices, and those include kinship and money. Okay. So they collectively argue for the significance of literary innovation. So this is not just about sort of economic stuff. It's, that's, you know, in the realm of physical exchange of physical things, but also sort of economy of terms, economy of language, economy of ideas, and literary innovation within political economic debate. Okay, so let's get into genres. Now, the first three chapters of the book look at what you call the symbiotic relation between the politics of literary genre and expansionist economics. And the first chapter focuses on the genre of the philosophical master's dialogue. Now, this chapter introduces the context of debates over frontiers and markets. And just to kind of speak back to something we mentioned a little earlier, because the scale of expansion under Emperor Wu, right, and it's that reign period that you're focusing on, was so unprecedented, there were needs to finance it. And so the advisors turned to consider commerce and industry as ways to do that. So the chapter focuses on two texts that both use the dialogue form and juxtapose them to kind of show important contrasts. So let's dive in. And I'm just going to kind of open things up and ask you to talk about whatever you think is important, right, about some of these texts. Okay. So the first text is the Qingzhong chapters of the Guanzi. So for listeners, can you introduce what's going on in this text and what's important for us to understand about this text to understand the larger argument you're making here in this chapter?
Thanks, Carla. The Guanzi is generally seen as the earliest theory of it's the earliest, the sort of foundations of Chinese economic thought. It's a set of texts from, it was compiled around the time of Emperor Wu, sort of 31st century BCE, that borrow the dialogue form, and unlike any text that I know of in the ancient world, actually propose a theory, a quantitative theory of economics. So even though, say, in ancient Greece, Hellenistic Egypt, or Kautilyan India, you find you have texts economic theories. They don't promote thinking about economic value or monetary value in strictly quantitative terms. So we find what's now called the earliest quantitative theory of money in these Qinzhong chapters. That is a theory of price that is determined by the relative quantities of things and money circulated at any given time. We find these sort of strangely modern ideas in these texts that you don't find elsewhere, even though that, you know, they have merchants and documents elsewhere in the ancient world. You don't find a theory that a quantitative theory in the same way. And I was struck by this, and I was struck by the two aspects of these texts, not only as they teach the Han reader how, for the first time in Chinese thought, how to think about the world, how to value exchange, not in terms of how it can best serve society, that is, in terms of litia, in terms of ritual propriety and so forth, but in terms of how to maximize profit, how to best benefit, how to think about the universal laws of the market. And this was new and unusual. And on the one hand, it was sort of teaching these economic theories. And on the other hand, it was also using, a new kind of rhetorical idiom. It was not only using strange new terms, Qinzhong being one of them, sort of literally light and heavy, but it's also translated as ratios, price ratios, or theories of value. It was also using strange new generic kind of tics, like creating a semi-fictional world using personifications at a time when, you know, this was not the norm in classical Chinese writing. It's you get it maybe in Zhuangzi or something like that, but that's always seen as something slightly suspicious. And most of these masters' dialogues, that the form itself is usually based on, you know, historical figures. And instead, it was using these strange figures like, you know, Mr. Estimate and Measure. Literally, this is the term used, and Mr. Calculate Why, Guiyi, as these figures who become the authorities within these texts, the masters within these texts, in teaching the reader how to understand the market. So what was weird for me about this text, and what really hadn't been talked about by theorists of or his economic historians, who are the only people really reading these texts, was these sort of literary aspects of the text that were doing something different precisely in order to teach the Han reader about issues of credit, you know, fiat currencies and so forth. So that was what I found strange about this sort of foundational text in Chinese economic theory that was, you know, is also disregarded in any kind of history of economic thought that you buy in a regular bookstore, which, you know, only sort of goes from Aristotle on. It sort of ignores anything in the Chinese tradition, or even in Chinese history of Chinese economic thought, which sort of overlook these rhetorical aspects of the text. So I was sort of interested in thinking about how to bring these issues together, which I thought was actually important for what was going on at the time. So that's the Guanzi text.
Thank you. And there's also, I mean, along the lines of looking anew with different kind of readerly eyes at a text that might not look like a literary text, there's this really wonderful moment in that part of the chapter where you bring us into the text of a sort of directions to calculate a quantity that features a fox going through customs.
That's right.
So there's these great ways of like treating, you know, these directions for calculation in the spirit of literary texts that I did that are really amusing and kind of awesome. So a fox goes through customs. I direct listeners to that. It's particularly awesome. So we have here the masters are these kind of personified abstract economic principles, right? Mr. Calculate Why, Mr. Calculate and Measure. In contrast, you kind of juxtapose this with a very different kind of text that's also concerned with markets and frontiers, but actually has a very different approach. So what are some of the major differences between the Guanzi Qinzhong chapters and this other text, Debate on Salt and Iron? And why are those differences important for you?
The Debate on Salt and Iron is a much better known text, especially to historians of China, because it is one of the dialogues that really illustrate the kinds. It's a purported sort of historical account of a debate that took place soon after Emperor Wu's death. That is a kind of retrospective debate about how good he was in terms of the market and of the frontiers. Now, a couple of the key differences here is one, in this case, the author who's clearly identifies, clearly promotes what the classical scholars who are on one side of the debate and privileges them over the Emperor Wu's former economic advisor, who is clearly someone who's identified with someone who was the son of a merchant, was good at calculations, clearly was, from other historical sources, was a Guanxian type economist, and he was one who really masterminded the market expansion to finance economic imperialism. And in this text, the debate on salt and iron, we have a celebration of classicism itself. So that those who are the masters here that emerge out of this debate are really the so-called wunxue, the so-called classical scholars who endlessly cite from the classics, from Confucius and others, to try to restore the sense that the true expert for the emperor in thinking about how to manage the political economy, both the markets and the frontiers, is no longer the economist. It's no longer, you know, the one with the economics degree. It's the philosopher. It's the classical scholar. It's a reassertion not only of this traditional figure, the Mencius or the Confucius, as the person who best knows how social community should regulate value, but it's also it's an idea that's profoundly based in text. And again, they use these this idea of the root of returning to fundamentals, returning to Bun, as opposed to commerce more. And this idea of returning to the root, returning to agriculture, is paired with the idea of returning to the classical text. So what they're promoting is not only a return to a world without markets, which is what they are essentially doing, but also a world in which classical texts were the basis of authority. It's not the statisticians, it's not the economists anymore. So it's both ideological, but it's also about the place of texts in the world. Whereas, as we saw with Guanzi, it's a sort of semi-fictional world that was no longer interested. The Qingzhong texts don't cite from the classics in the way that the debate in Salt and Iron does. The debate in Salt and Iron is a much more familiar text to any reader of early Chinese texts, really.
Great. And so in the chapter, in this really beautiful way, by putting these two texts, which are not unknown texts, but are not usually read in this way, next to each other and in the same dialogue, we're really getting to see these texts anew, in I think really, really helpful ways. Similarly, the next chapter actually takes us into another genre, but does something, is a similar kind of contribution. So this chapter focuses on a word I'm going to mispronounce. You can pronounce epideictic.
Yep, that's how I pronounce it.
Okay,
yeah.
Great. Epideictic Fu. Now, these Fu often include lists of things. You talk about this in the context of a kind of material poetics. And this chapter really centers on one in particular. This is Sima Xiangru's Fu on the Excursion Hunt of the Son of Heaven. This is the earliest Fu that is formally presented to the imperial court. And it's a really amazing reading of this Fu in the context of the idea of tribute and in the context of a larger discourse of economy and economics. So this chapter shows that this Fu, in your words, was structured around the economic metaphor of linguistic expenditure. So this idea of linguistic expenditure, can you bring us into what you mean by linguistic expenditure here and talk a little bit about how to understand that in the context of what's going on in this Fu?
Sure, absolutely. The Fu is a structured also as a dialogue. It's a prose poetic form that became the most popular literary genre during the Han Dynasty, sort of shot to fame during this period. The dialogue in this particular Fu is between three imaginary figures. And again, there's this issue of personification. Savacuous, Master Improbable, and Lord No Such. And what they do is boast about the their three imaginary envoys of warring states China, of different states in warring state China. And they basically boast about the contents of their respective masters' gardens. And one of them, the last one, is the envoy to the emperor. And so ultimately he's the one that wins because his is the biggest. And what's interesting is the way in which in the sort of prose sections between the long poetic bits, which are sort of chock-a-block full of alliterative rhyming and rhythmically complex lists of exotica, basically, they basically criticize each other for how verbose their speeches are. So we have a resemblance made, a kind of self-reflexive attention that's given to the relationship between words and things. What they criticize each other for is for boasting, that is speaking too much. The issue here is really around length and ornament. That is between speaking too much, too long, that their speeches are too long, and for speaking too beautifully. And you know, there are many different sort of adjectives for what this idea of ornamentality in language looks like. So the metaphor of linguistic expenditure is one that they use to describe the problem with each other's language. And so traditionally, the criticism of this particular of epideictic Fu is that or what's strange about this epideictic Fu is that they, even though they criticize each other for each other's lack of thrift, for each other's excessiveness in language, which is also excessiveness in the size of each other's gardens when they should be deferring to the emperor, these are the two sort of signal features of the Fu that for which it is best known. So what makes the Fu so different from the two other main traditions, poetic traditions in Chinese literary history, that is Book of Classic of Odes tradition and the Elegies of True tradition, is precisely that these the sort of ridiculously long the ridiculous length of these poems, and also the sort of very ornate aspect of them. So that's the issue of linguistic expenditure in there that has been the subject of sort of endless debate by those who have criticized, you know, even through to the May 4th movement and beyond. And you know, it was a genre that was sort of burned in the Cultural Revolution. The issue was that it was seen to reflect an embrace of not only imperialism, since these exotica was seen as tokens of imperial expansion of booty from expansion, but also of the love of material things, of materiality. So it's a complex genre that plays with precisely the poetics that will emerge during the Han Dynasty of this issue of whether it was thrifty enough or not. I forgot to mention it at the very end of the poem, of the final and the longest speech within the Fu. The emperor sort of renounces his excessiveness, but it's always seen as coming too late. So there's a sort of arc, a structure to this Fu that is seen as common, but is seen as being not enough, not thrifty enough for the reader. So these are the terms by which it's normally discussed as a genre.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. And so it's clearly, I think, for the listener, this is a really productive way of integrating this conversation into this broader conversation of economy, right, and of exchange and of spending and thrift. Now, one of the other things that's really noticeable and really beautiful for me about this chapter is the attention to materiality in another sense. And so you have this really wonderful section of this chapter that looks at parallels between visual and verbal or sonic styles by comparing Fu and visual sources. And you look at representations of sleeve dancers and of clouds. And I mention this because I think even for this reason alone, the book is worth the price of admission. Your attentiveness to sound and to the sonic and to translation in rendering these Fu into English is really astounding. Just as sort of an element of the translator's craft, your translations of these Fu are amazing. Do you have any kind of comments on that? I mean, is that something that you spent a lot of time on? It's a really noticeable part of this chapter.
That's very sweet of you. I mean, I mean, a couple of things. One, the issue of the material analogs was. I think exactly the sleeve dancers and the clouds were the two I was looking at. And what I was interested in is in art history, I've learned so much from art historians and, you know, the ways in which they talk about changes in hand visual style. And there's, you know, a lot of attention to how the swirl or the swish of hand dynasty art is something that they look at. And what interested me is the way in which, they call it kind of the sonic landscape, if you will, of the Fu is so particular, especially in its use around describing the swish and the swirl of the same kinds of things that feature in hand art, you know, the sleeve dances and so forth. And so what I was trying to do is translating these sort of euphonic sort of binomes, these word forms that are strung together, these ways of using language that was unusual, the patterns of sound that were used particularly in the Fu and pioneered by Sima Xiangru and then later taken up that was seen as characteristic of the Fu, these kinds of sonic experiments I wanted to try and translate in a slightly different way from the way they usually are, which is by finding a matching word, but by sort of iterating the soundscape. So I had things like frou frou flap flap or sussering or something. But I wanted to get the fact that some of these words sort of play on the edge of nonsense and new words or rare words. So I did play around with the OED a bit in finding words that were, you know, just about on the edge of recognition a little bit. So I'm glad you appreciated that. But I did spend a little more time than I should have on it, but I didn't, the normal way of going about a proper, you know, translation is to, you know, go through the, I relied heavily on the work of other translators, put it that way. So I was playing around with the soundscapes, but thank you for bringing that up, Bella.
I think it's great. Among many other reasons is it's sort of, you know, in a lot of scholarship on these Fu, there's an attention to materiality insofar as look at all these objects, right? Like look at this list of things. This really takes an attentiveness to the materiality to the next level by producing a material experience through the translator's craft insofar as you're creating a sonic landscape in your translation that really kind of speaks from and speaks to the kind of sonic materiality that comes out of the text you're translating from. So I think it was awesome. So the third chapter is the final chapter on a particular genre. And this focuses on the genre of historiography. Now, it shows how Han writers are using the genre of historiography to challenge or to reformulate what you call the ideal of agricultural tributary empire. Now, we haven't talked very much, if at all, about this idea of a tributary relation, a tributary system, but that's very much something that kind of emerges throughout the book. So this chapter focuses on showing a contrast between the treatment of these issues in the Shiji and in the Hanshu. And you are showing a particular concern with how, in your words, material accumulation begins dissolving sort of classical hierarchical differences between the Xiongnu and the Chinese. So there's this really interesting way that I think the way you were describing the project from which this book emerged, right, the sort of original dissertation project, mm-hmm. you can see kind of resonances of that here. So let's look at these texts in dialogue in that respect. The Shiji, as you're giving it to us here, is considering a particular figure in a way and its relation to the Xiongnu in a way that's really different from the way the Hanchu does it. So it's considering, in particular, the business person or the commodity producer as a kind of ethical subject, as the moral center of the market. So in the Shiji, the state is not the moral center of the market, it's the business person, right? And as a result of this, like as you put it here, Han envoys, not the Xiongnu, are the ones that require regulation. Okay, so can you kind of take us into this? What's critical about this aspect of the treatment of these issues by the Shiji for us to understand the larger argument in this chapter? And how does the Hanshu's treatment of these issues differ?
Mm-hmm. Thanks. It might seem at first a little bit odd that I'm pairing these two chapters or highlighting these two chapters, one about the Xiongnu, one about the account of the moneymakers, of the commodity producers, as I translate it. I think both of them, just to go to your last question, are chapters that the Hanshu takes up, copies, but sort of reframes in different ways and rewrites them through reframing them according to a different kind of plot that I call the sort of classical tributary plot. That is, for the Hanshu, more like the sort of debate in Salt and Iron classical scholar, the state is ideally agricultural. Any markets are state regulated, and there's a the classical texts are the foundations for historical knowledge and for political action. So it's a sort of classical text, and in both, and whereas what I finding in the Shiji, in these two texts that in the two chapters which were both tied to controversies around the Shiji as a text that became partly lost during the Han Dynasty. What I was interested in was the way in which these two particular chapters, one the business, the account of moneymakers, was condemned, openly condemned by one of the co-authors of the Hanshu, and the other chapter was the account of Xiongnu was I think most people know, tied to Sima Qian's own eventual castration due to his being tied to tied to what he thought mistakenly being seen as defending a defector to the Xiongnu. So there are these two chapters that are tied to the Hanshu's sort of negative evaluation of the Shiji that the Hanshu nevertheless takes up and reframes quite explicitly. So what we have in the case of the Shiji and the Xiongnu is an attention to the problem of ethnographic representation rather than simply a representation of the alien other. The Hanshu, as I argue, sort of reframes that explicitly. It takes out this attention to the envoys who are the problem, and instead just says, you know, these Xiongnu can never be corrected, and it sort of brings in a much more phobic later Han rhetoric of the Xiongnu as the alien other. At the same time, with the biography of the moneymakers, it reframes these biographies that in the Shiji was seen as more clearly as models of an ethical businessman, of, you know, people who redistributed their earnings without the intervention of the state into parables of vice. So it uses its end comment to show how these these moneymakers basically were led to social destruction and chaos. So it's what I'm interested in here in sort of the broader picture is how these key texts that historians, economic historians, political historians use to reconstruct the history of the political economy, these two sources can't be read as one as they usually are, but there's a tension between the two that has something to do with what happens between the two texts. And I wanted to draw attention to that. That's what that chapter's about.
Fantastic. Thank you. So we've seen, I think, in each one of these three first chapters on genre, that each one of these is both taking us into a particular kind of text or a particular kind of narrative, but also showing that really deep pluralities within that kind of narrative and the way that we can't really just trace a linear, unproblematic story about Han, you know, attitudes toward economics or literary texts. So the second half of the book and the last two body chapters of the book move from genre to practice. And this shifts us to studies of material and embodied practices. The first chapter, or chapter four, but the first chapter in this section, focuses on kinship. And in a really interesting way, what this is doing is putting into dialogue the history of the conjugal household unit. So the history of the conjugal household unit and the history of frontiers. And it's making these two kinds of history speak to each other. So chapter four argues that two of the most important developments in Chinese frontier history, this is imperial interstate diplomacy, or Heqin, and long-distance tributary trade across Eurasia, which you sort of speak of in the context of Silk Road, these originated in discourses and practices that importantly departed from classical ideals of kinship. So there's this really interesting story here about the ways that classical ideas of kinship and ideas of trade and frontiers are informing each other by being sort of, and we see that by them being juxtaposed in this chapter. Now, really interestingly, one of the figures that emerges in this chapter is the figure of the working woman. It's really striking, and it seems really important here. So could you speak a little bit to that? What is happening here with the idea of women's work and the way that's being multiply configured in this part of the book?
Yeah, that's a great question. What I wanted to think about was the recognition, you know, sort of as a sort of standard gender studies question, the recognition, non-recognition of women's work and what was going on here. Often when one thinks about gender history for, you know, early China, especially from a literary perspective, you know, that there are some set texts out there. What happens in the Han Dynasty is you get these new writings for women, Ban Zhao's Precepts for Women, Liu Xiang's Biographies of Exemplary Women. These are well-known texts that became a model for, you know, women in future dynasties. And what is so striking in reading them is the ways in which they the women's work as several scholars have already pointed out is valued for its moral import. It's seen as a way it's seen as a sort of wifely work. It's a way of turning oneself into the virtuous wife. And what I was interested in is the way in which this is also these sort of classicizing, you know, classicizing texts. If read in the way that I read them, really represented women as performing this traditional work which they're tied to within the household, and as privileging a certain kind of spinning and weaving that was very different from, say, the weaving of brocade or gauzes and things like that. It was very much tied to being at home, being a good wife and a good mother. Whereas what was sort of overlooked and is often seen as not being part of this story, of this rise of these new texts that became ever more concerned that the woman's work be represented as part of her wifely and motherly duties was these sort of quantitative, the Guanxian text, the mathematical text that talk also about women's work, but in terms of maximizing their economic value. And I was interested in thinking about these Guanxian mathematical texts. You know, they have the mathematical texts have questions like, well, if a weaving girl doubles her product every day, how much will she earn in so many days, right? And I was thinking, you know, well, what kind of person comes up with an idea like that? Certainly not a classicizing text like Liu Xiang. And you know, historians, social historians have shown the ways in which women at this time were producing silk in factories and manors and so forth. And silk textiles were the main commodity of markets. And, you know, obviously the largest export commodity in the long distance so-called Silk Road tributary trade. What I was interested in is the ways in which these non-classical texts, quantitative texts, were also tying the ways in which one could maximize women's work was tied to the conquest of foreign places. So you get these sort of fables in the dialogues of harnessing the work of single women in order to produce enough silk in order to flood another market and then gain more territory. So there are these strange imaginations of world conquest, of conquering Tianxia through glutting the market, through economic means, which is the basis of the Guanxian idea, is political domination, world conquest through economic means. So what it was, this sort of imagination of using women's work in another way that seemed to be evacuated from any account of what the classicizing texts were doing to women's work there. So I wanted to sort of juxtapose this tension between two approaches to women's work that was happening around this time.
Great. Thank you so much. And I think, I hope it's certainly clear to me, and I'm sure it's clear to the listener, that one of the really wonderful things happening here, and this is an example of something that happens throughout the other chapters of the book as well, is you're taking this idea of a frontier, right, is that which kind of distinguishes characters through a boundary. And that frontier here is in an unexpected place, right? The frontier is in a place where, at least for me as a reader coming into this chapter, I wouldn't have been thinking of gender as a frontier that was being explored here. Right. And so there's a really
absolutely
interesting play, right? I mean, it's
absolutely. And this whole idea that this new diplomatic protocol that's being set up in the Han Dynasty involves this, you know, intermarriage, which may seem natural if you look at, you know, it was happening in Europe, it was happening, you know, lots of places in later periods. But the debates around, you know, kinship, they didn't send the actual princess, they sent another one, that, you know, the histories include this, the ways in which, you know, the wrong princess was sent out as part of this history. And it gets tied to debates over gender in the Han court at that time. So I was interested in the ways in which this issue of the frontier and the issue of abnormal or aberrant kinship at the center were being talked about at that time.
So. Thank you. So before we get to the coda, there is another really, again, wonderful chapter. And this is a chapter on money. Okay. Now, this chapter departs really interestingly and I think importantly from most existing scholarship on money during Emperor Wu's reign. And that is in so far as it highlights a lack of unity in meanings and practices of Han Dynasty money. So can you start us off here by speaking a little bit to the importance of this point, the lack of unity in these monetary practices? How is this departing from existing scholarship on the on money in this reign period? And why, for you, is it important to depart in that way and to emphasize this lack of unity?
I think most monetary histories or numismatic histories take the Emperor Wu's sort of, well, Emperor Qin and Emperor Wu between them sort of unified Chinese currency, and Emperor Wu introduced the coin, that sort of circular coin with a square hole, as the sort of emblematic token of this new economy that that's become so sort of iconic of Chinese empire. And that's, you know, generally seen as what matters in monetary history at this time. And what I was interested in is that there were, alongside the sort of historical and sort of classical parables and accounts of money that gave different accounts of the origins of money. So you get a lot of new accounts of money, where it came from. Did it begin in the very ancient period? Did merchants invent? Did art? You know, did money originate in the markets, or did it originate with an emperor? You know, different ways of these sorts of stories are well-known parts of this monetary history. But what I was interested in was thinking about this alongside three other monetary practices, namely, I think, burial practices of money, that is sort of the spiritual domain. And there are a lot of sort of excavated documents that showed that, you know, Han people saw a sort of interactive dynamic relationship between, you know, the economy of the afterlife and their present economy through all these sort of contracts to the dead and so forth. Secondly, they were using experimental coin designs and so forth that did imagine, it seems, the use of Western coin designs. Usually the Chinese numismatic tradition, the Western numismatic tradition, is seen as different. One used Western coins are silver and use pictures. Chinese coins are bronze and don't have pictures. But there seems to be some experiments at this time in the Han Dynasty, just as Han envoys were encountering Western coinage. And thirdly, there were these, again, the Guanxian quantitative approaches to money that thought about, that imagined a world in which all currencies were interchangeable. So again, we have this Guanxian idea that you can have a fiat currency. Basically, there's a new way of thinking about money that didn't have anything to do with, you know, giving money a meaning within classical history. So those are basically the sort of different sets of practices and literary approaches that I kind of tried to sort out. So that's it.
So I think, really interestingly, just as the chapter is expanding what we think of when we think about money, right? What counts under these rubrics? And you're showing, you know, burial money, experimental minting, also classicizing money, right? Like discourses that are talking about money's place in ethics and historiography and classical texts, and the idea mm-hmm. of quantified money. There's also a parallel thread in this chapter where this focus on coins is also challenging how we think about and what we think about when we think about text. So one of the really interesting things that's happening here is that coins and various kinds of coins and various kinds of materials and ingots, et cetera, become documents. Silk mittens become documents. Other excavated burial goods become documents. And so I think it would be great if you could speak a little bit to that in terms of your methodology for this chapter, the kind of integration of material artifacts as documents, as texts into this larger narrative that you are weaving. Can you talk a little bit about the challenges of that, your attitude toward that, and why that's important to do for the particular kind of thing that you're doing here in this part of the book?
That's a good question. I guess I had a lot of trouble with this chapter in the sense that in reading comparative accounts of money from, you know, Greece and South Pacific and so forth, or sort of the anthropological accounts, you know, there's a lot of work out there about whether we think about, you know, gift versus money economies and how that distinction does or doesn't hold. And in the Chinese case, there's still a lot of debate about the beginnings of Chinese money. But I guess what this issue of money as a text is moot during this period, because people did not, different hand writers were playing with, they were toying with the term B for money, which could also be used for offerings. And that there were ways in which people at this time were rewriting monetary history by playing with different terms for, you know, exchange and so forth, and different narratives of that. So this isn't a very good answer to your question. I guess the larger stakes, I guess is your question, is whether or not the sort of two structuring questions, you know, do we see Chinese monetary history as something separate from Western monetary history? Do we see ancient and modern monies as something separate? Those sorts of questions, you know, how do we define money and so forth? These are all things I had to think about in this chapter without laying out firm definitions, precisely because they were playing with money in different ways. Silk was used as a form of money, but that depends on how we define money. Do we, you know, there are different ways, special purpose, general purpose, there, you know, different regions, things were used differently. So there were a lot of, it was more of a sort of messing up of easy histories than an easy kind of discussion of it. I think the bit that gets to the issue of the text is in the classicizing section of this chapter, where I talk about the discussion of the wen, of the inscription of on coins, as being the focus of anxiety for historians and classicists who use that, the issue of wen, as being to talk about the sort of classic anxiety you get in you know, many economies, Roman economy, Renaissance Britain, of the tension between material substance and inscribed value. So the issue of wen also becomes a way in which historians, historiographers, Han historiographers and writers talked about what wen really was meant to mean. And this issue of wen, as it merges through my book, I think is one of these sort of iconic terms that's you know, sort of literary decorum, culture and so forth, civilization, that seem to emblematize, you know, Chinese, China itself, and how we should think about Chinese literary culture. And that was one of the issues that I was sort of taking to task a little bit, just questioning through this study. So in that way, this issue of wen features in this chapter.
Great. Thank you. And I think, to just kind of add to that also, just the issue of what counts as one, right, what counts as writing, is also one that emerges really interestingly from your own practice of integrating documents that are not just, you know, written text on obvious textual, you know, the obvious kinds of media that you would write text on, but also these sort of mittens and, you know, woven inscriptions and things like
right.
that. Right. Yeah, so the practice, I think, the practice that you're bringing to bear for the research on this chapter also really interestingly mirrors the troubling of that category that exists as a trope throughout the book.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, again, I'm learning a lot from sort of art historians and so forth, you know, but yeah, doing my best.
Thank you. So as we come to the end of the book, we come to a coda that is not to be missed. This is a coda called Counter History, Connected Histories, and Comparative Literature. And in this coda, you're making some really interesting and really important general arguments about the benefits and the importance of doing a kind of work or kinds of work that are, I think, really modeled in this book for a number of different fields that you're speaking to. So I'll just, because just in the interest of not keeping you for another couple of hours, I'll just ask you if you might speak to just a couple of them, because they seem really, really important, especially for our listeners. So you make the point here that it's important for comparative literature to pay attention to pre-modern histories of contact. And I know that this is part of, I mean, the book really speaks to and speaks from a larger field of, you know, what sometimes alternately is considered Silk Road studies, Silk Road histories, contact histories, connected histories. So in light of bringing those sorts of studies into dialogue with more sort of comparative literature, literary studies, can you speak to that point? Why should comparative literature pay attention to pre-modern histories of contact, and what might that do to change the field?
This comes from my, original dissertation idea that I would do sort of a Greek-China comparison. And it's been one thing that, I respect a lot of work that's come out in this tradition, and I do classes, doing this sort of stuff. One of the aspects of this project, which is, it's important in its own right, generally seeks to undermine sort of easy comparisons. East does this, West does that. One of the issues I found was that there's in comparative literature, there's often a sort of distillation of the source text, the base text of comparison to a set of generally sort of Confucian classics, especially poetic texts, a set of genres. And one of the problems that I was trying to redress was to build on on each side was, the movements, what inspired me as sort of undergraduate in Greek stuff was, the work that shifted classics into basically Mediterranean studies, and the ways, the work by, Burckhardt and other people like that looked at, Greece's relationship with other periods, or later Hellenistic work that ties Greece with the Near East. And I was interested on the China side with, aesthetic studies of China's relationship with, say Sanskrit and so forth. And what was getting lost in these sort of complete studies of the earlier sort of pre-Tang period was this kind of larger acumen through which these literary histories developed. Often sort of the poetic tradition or the literary tradition is sort of seen as unfolding in a vacuum. And this, to me, seemed to iterate a kind of axial age, unintentionally, to iterate a kind of axial age civilizations mode of comparison, even as a sort of undermining, deconstructing, and whatever it was. I was just, and I think back to your earlier question about the stakes in thinking about texts, material texts, and literary texts, is that the sort of archaeologists, frontier archaeologists, are sort of at the forefront of showing how much contact there really was, and in sort of thinking about issues of contact, there's a way in which one can think about aesthetic history, literary history. So something that don't develop out of sort of centralized sort of monolithic cultural traditions. And I guess I've been pushing, my book sort of pushes too much this need to historicize literature. My sort of new historicist way of thinking about what was needed to be done if I wanted to bring pre-modern literatures into sort of comparative literature in ways that hadn't already been done, as much as I hoped. And obviously other people are working on this too, but this is something that I was hoping to contribute to.
Great. Thank you so much. And I think one of along the lines of thinking anew about and thinking with comparison, I mean, the book also shows us a model for how comparative literature, comparative history can also be happening and be a kind of methodology that allows us to see within what otherwise might look like. It's one kind of linguistic context, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. It enables one to see and recognize the hybridity that's always there, and to precisely not necessarily name that as being Chinese. And you know what? This whole issue, you know, back to state, you know, the beginning is, you know, in ethnography, if you determine in advance who the foreigner is, you know, one is immediately undermining one's project. So, I think that was precisely what I was trying to do. So, yes, thank you.
So, Tamara, I've taken up a lot of your time, and we're already at the end of our conversation, but we haven't even scratched the surface of all the information that are in the book. Is there anything in particular that we didn't have a chance to talk about, but that you'd like to mention for listeners, and perhaps especially for listeners who haven't had a chance to read the book?
No, I think you've wonderfully covered everything.
Okay. Well, not everything.
Thank you.
Now that the book is out, and congratulations on an amazing book that I think is going to contribute to lots of different fields and for good reason, what's next for you? Are there any projects that are currently inspiring you?
Yes. So thank you for asking. I have a couple of two book projects that I'm working on, both that sort of come out of this project, but one of them I've sort of been working on since graduate school. One of them, the one that comes sort of more directly out of this project of Savage Exchange is a sort of continuation of looking at literary and economic practices with the rise of the Silk Road. You know, the more I sort of talk to people, the more texts I read, the more interesting the sort of later Han and sort of, you know, Six Dynasties and beyond period looks and thinking about transformations of genre, cross-cultural transformation of genre, new media, and different ways, especially with the rise of Buddhism, of thinking about the use of metals, you know, massive statues or bullion, you know, these sorts of issues that is also being studied by sort of comparatists or by people in other cultures, you know, at exactly this time. You know, I'm thinking of, you know, people work on, say, the Christian economy and so forth. So I'm interested in, you know, thinking about this, what's going on across the Eurasian continent at this time, but it's, you know, especially across China's relationship with other literary and trade exchanges at this time. And then the second project is actually it's quite different. It's on the modern invention of the idea of the Silk Road. It's sort of on the modern idea of pre-modern globalization since sort of the coining of the term in 1877 by Richthofen. I've done a fair amount of work over the years about this, the transformation of this idea over about a century. It's very different in different discourses as to the way we use it today. And I'm sort of trying to trace a genealogy of that.
Great. Well, good luck with that as well. It sounds great. And thank you so much for making the time. It's really been a pleasure, Tamara.
Thank you so much, Carla. Appreciate that.
You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.